Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming to the Torah for Tycoons session today. My name is David Richman, and I'm going to be moderating this session. I was just pressed into service 5 minutes ago, so excuse me if I have to read these announcements and extemporize on what I'm going to say. The program gives its thanks to the Harry Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron, you see him today, for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. It's celebrating its bar mitzvah year, the 13th year. For the past 12 years, Kol has brought the Torah perspectives on business and personal ethics to over 500 people through this program. Today's session is CLE accredited. There's an affidavit around here somewhere for those youngsters who are still lawyers and need credit, not old guys like me and Sandy here. The next class will be March 1st, like about a month from today, I guess, exactly a month from today. Class will focus on immigration and security. Not a relevant topic these days at all, hardly. And Ken Stern, partner at Stern & Curry, and I can tell you Ken Stern is a very fine immigration lawyer. I used to refer many clients to him, or people to him. And also Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, of course, the senior educator for the Kollel, will speak on immigration and security. Kollel is going to have its 19th anniversary celebration. I guess it's a dinner?
Not quite.
But the celebration will be on Tuesday, February 28th at Aish. 4 weeks from now, Kollel will present the Betzalel Award to Rabbi Daniel and Adina Kraus, and will celebrate the opening of a new Torah Center in southeast Denver and a temporary home in west Denver, in addition to Denver. To put an ad or reserve for the event, contact the Kollel. Rabbi Schwab is here, or speak to a Kollel member after the class. If you missed the past classes, they are recorded, and you can find them on the Kollel's website, which is www.denverkollel.org. You can also find the latest info on Kollel programming at the website and archive classes on other topics on the website. Now, I want to introduce today's presenters. First, this is Rabbi Mordechai Fleisch. He's a senior educator for the Denver Community Kollel. I'm assuming everybody kind of knows him because he comes to these every time they have one. Okay. The special guest today is Ben Figa. And I want to tell you, I've known Ben since the day he was born because his parents, his mother is here, and his late father were very good friends of mine. I always remember the day of Ben's Brit Milah. Because... He doesn't remember, but I do, because I left from there, I went to play softball, I slid into second base, the ball hit me in my mouth, I got about 30 stitches that night. It was always the night of his Brit Milah. I always remember that. Ben is a graduate of Cherry Creek High School. He went to Northwestern University undergrad, following in the footsteps of his illustrious parents there. Came back to Denver to go to University of Denver Law School. Finished Denver, he clerked for Chief Justice Bender of the Colorado State Supreme Court. From there, he went to work for a law firm called Semple and Farrington, which did a lot of government-related work. Actually, a lot of, I think, representation also, like teachers and the school
Denver,
board, right?
Denver Public Schools.
The Denver Public Schools. After he left Semple, he became a district attorney, so a prosecuting attorney, in Boulder, under the then Boulder DA, Stan Garnett. Stan Garnett, still a Boulder DA, but Ben worked for Stan. Then he went to work in the governor's office. He was assistant counsel or deputy counsel to Governor Hickenlooper, where he did many, many things, including vetting judges. We used to talk all the time about judges. Oh, I should say I'm a judge on the Colorado Court of Appeals. And from the governor's office, he moved on to the city attorney's office, where he's been about a little less than a year now, right? A little longer than a year. Time flies. Where he's been doing litigation representing the city. When Rabbi Fleischer contacted me about getting somebody who could talk about government ethics, I said, Ben's your man. He hired Ben at a very high premium price, I'm sure, and I let them go ahead with the program now.
Thank you, David. Thank you to Kollel for having me. David mentioned, I, for about 2 years, was deputy legal counsel to Governor Hickenlooper, and I'm now an assistant city attorney for Denver. And one of the things that always comes up when you're in-house counsel for a governor or a city is ethics and conflicts of interest and what types of gifts officials, state officials or local officials, take while they are acting on behalf of the public. And there's all sorts of law which we'll get into. But as part of this topic, I wanted to not just bring up sort of the legal consideration, which is, you know, as an in-house counsel, you always think about the legal considerations, but there's also policy and political implications to what a government official does. And the topic is very timely because very recently a group of law professors has been pushing the envelope with respect to Trump and the business interests that he has internationally, and also some of his clientele at his hotels. And it's been a relatively obscure constitutional provision, but has started to get more focus recently, just based on Trump's ties to business. So the clause which the lawsuit has been filed, and the lawsuit has been filed within the last 2 or 3 weeks, so you'll probably start seeing more in the news about it, but it's the emoluments clause. And so if you will open your handout, I'm going to go through it. And it's not just President Trump who has had to deal with it, but it covers government officials for the federal government too. So we're talking secretaries of state. We'll talk about Secretary Clinton when she was Secretary of State and her foundation. We'll also talk about Barack Obama, him accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. So if you'll turn with me, let's just go through it really quickly. So the clause says, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office or office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And so you have to take a look at when this was drafted. This was drafted back into the, you know, back in the 1700s when we were in a time of kings. And Rabbi Fleischer will talk about more historically from the Jewish perspective how, you know, traditionally we were under monarchies. But so the concept of a representative form of government is a relatively modern concept. But in any case, I wanted to talk specifically about those three instances, you know, Trump's organization's ties to foreign governments. And so I assembled just a couple of facts from the lawsuit. So in Trump Tower in New York, he has some very notable foreign companies or entities that are large tenants of his. So the Bank of China and the Abu Dhabi Tourism and Culture Authority, which is state-sponsored, they're both owned by foreign countries. They're the two largest tenants within Trump Towers in New York. And further, as part of the lawsuit, there's an allegation that the Embassy of Kuwait is scheduled to hold its National Day of Celebration at Trump's hotel in Washington, D.C. And we have to keep in mind that, you know, Trump is one of our richest presidents. He's a billionaire, or so he says. And the Constitution is flexible enough to have all types of people, rich, poor. But the question is about whether his ties, his business ties, create such a, an influence on him that it's suspect. One other thing I would mention is that the Trump Organization itself is seeking financing, permits, and approvals, in a number of different countries, including China, India, the UAE, Indonesia, Turkey, Scotland, Philippines, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Taiwan. And so the question is whether so these are all paying clients of his. You know, the two tenants in Trump Tower, they pay for a lease, and there's a lot of talk about how the lawsuit might not be successful because of the idea of arm's length transactions, that the clients are paying for and receiving services. We can talk about it a little bit more, but I also want to talk about Barack Obama's acceptance of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. So I, just to give you a little bit of background about that, Alfred Nobel had set aside a fund for champions of peace, and this was back in the 1800s, and it's continued to today. Whoever gets the Nobel Peace Prize, they are selected by a committee of five persons who are elected by the Norwegian Storting. I'm sure I butchered that. But they are, that's the Norwegian parliament. And as part of the prize, not only do they get a medal and a certificate, but there's a $1.4 million prize that's attached to it. So President Obama did receive that prize. I don't know exactly what he did with it. He may have given it to charity, but he did receive a prize on behalf of that. And the question in that case was whether the Nobel Committee is a foreign state, because it's appointed by the Norwegian Parliament, but it is not an official Norwegian entity. The other example that I wanted to talk about, and then we can open it up for discussion, is about the Clinton Foundation. So while Hillary Clinton was serving as Secretary of State, she came under fire because there were a lot of foreign governments that had reportedly donated to the Clinton Foundation, including Oman, Qatar, Kuwait, and Algeria. The one that got a lot of press was when the Algerian government donated about $500,000 to the Clinton Foundation. This was with regard to the Haitian relief when they were having the earthquake there. But the way Hillary and her foundation, the way they talked about it to the press is they said that Hillary Clinton was never receiving any salary from the foundation, nor did she have any official role in the organization. I'll throw it out to the group. Do any of these instances really strike you as influence, and specifically inappropriate influence of government officials? Well, and that's a good point. So there can be all of these, I guess, legal ways to try to distance yourself from the money or the gifts. But what I think you're getting at is the idea of soft influence, that by donating to the Clinton Foundation, these foreign governments were able to get...
I wouldn't characterize it as soft.
You think it's hard?
Yes.
How would you differentiate the Trump situation then? That's even closer, isn't it? He's getting direct money to his business entities from government agencies that give access to him, if that's what you're saying.
He is, or he will receive.
He has been, and he still is. Till today he is. I mean, I think what this turns on, I think the lawsuit may turn on this, what does the word emolument mean? Not a commonly used word anymore. I don't really know. I haven't looked it up. But I think it means a benefit.
It means a gift.
A gift. So if it's, and that's what you're saying, if China pays lease payments to Trump Tower, but in exchange they get rental space, it may not be a gift.
That's right.
On the other hand, it does. If you give a gift, there doesn't have to be a quid pro quo, right? If someone gave a gift to the president or the secretary of state or anybody, it's not a bribe. It's different from a bribery statute. It's not that the government official has to then do something for that person. Simply accepting the gift is the problem. You know, historically, though, presidents have always accepted gifts from foreign states. Usually, I guess what they do is they give them away. I don't really know. But it really turns on how emolument is interpreted. This clause, is, as far as I know, has never been applied by any federal court, I don't believe. It's never come up before.
So, for me, it seems very different. I don't agree with the last statement. One is direct profit to somebody. The other, as we're discussing, what's a gift? It goes to other people, including the Nobel Peace Prize. I don't know whether people get paid to sit on that committee. I believe they do not. But the money that is there in that fund gets given away to other people. So it seems, I mean, that's the dividing line for me. The profit of business versus in the Clinton Foundation as well. She didn't receive anything. I know there's the question of access. I'm just saying it's money given away. It's given to AIDS. It's given to...
So you think what the money goes towards,
who
or how it's,
exactly.
how it's used is
makes a difference to me.
Well, so I will tell you that all of these are arguably legal, but the larger question is whether presidents or secretaries of state, and this is a question that would come up all the time in. The governor's office is, even if you can accept the gift, does it look bad if you do? There's this notion that if you are a public servant, you don't want the appearance of impropriety. So does anybody have any comments on that?
I think if it's a challenge, if somebody's coming in with... already with his business, what do we want him to do? I mean, how can he untie those ties aside from walking away from
sell them?
Divest of the business, which is what people have been advising the
that's quite a challenge. But I think also the balance of power that is set up in a democracy can help with that to some degree.
That's one of the ways that you can theoretically distance himself so that he doesn't know which interests he he might be benefiting or not benefiting from. But it's a way to distance yourself. But
he didn't do it.
Right.
He has not done it.
Right, and there's a reason he's not taking a salary. Because he doesn't need it, and he continues to make money while he's in the presidency. He doesn't need to take a salary from the people of the United States.
So let me turn to one other example, and I'll keep this brief. So it's if you want to turn to the next page, so I want to talk about a more everyday type of example. This is something that came up when I was working in the governor's office. Is can a public official accept Super Bowl tickets? So back in 2014, is pretty forgettable. Well, for me, I wanted to forget it. The Broncos were playing the Seattle Seahawks. At that time, Governor Hickenlooper paid for his airfare tickets and lodging for him and his son Teddy to go. The state paid for lodging and airfare of his chief of staff and senior media advisor, but they paid for their own tickets. But, lodging and airfare was on the state's dime. During the trip, the governor did appear on, some media shows, including This Week with George Stephanopoulos, and that's how he justified his employees going, is that they were serving him while he was doing press. For Mayor Hancock, there was a separate commission, the Metro Denver Sports Commission, that paid more than $40,000 in costs, which drew donations from Comcast, the engineering firm CH2M Hill, or CH2M, and the law firm Brownstein, Hyatt, and Farber. And the trip also included his mother and two staffers. And so I've put Colorado's Amendment 41, which is the state gift ban, and also the Denver Ethics Code. And I will just say that for the governor and the mayor, they were cleared to go. These were all technically legal under the ethics code, but it again raises the same issue of, even if you can accept a gift legally, is the appearance not something you should do? So I think I'm about out of time, but unless you want to, we can.
I think we'll probably loop back around as we discuss.
Okay, so keep that in mind, and I'll turn it over to Rabbi Fleischer. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ben. Thank you very much, David. So, as you see over here, I have this long, scary-looking list of sources, and we'll try to make sense out of them, see how they apply to some of the issues. I don't know that we can reach all the issues. I'm not going to solve the country's problems in the next half hour, I can assure you of that. But just try to get an overview of the Torah's viewpoint. And we're going to see that really much of the discussion does not take place in the Talmud, but rather in more recent, relatively recent sources, more over the last 1,000 years, I say relatively recent sources. Torah being, having been given at Sinai some 3,000 years ago, the Talmud having been written about some 1,500 years ago. So we do start with a passage in the Talmud that says, it is forbidden to save oneself with one fellow's money. That's a separate discussion, not today, but what is relevant to us is the Talmud talking regarding a king, a monarch, specifically King David. And the Talmud there says that the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, if you will, of that time, of the Jewish people, told King David, "You're a king, and a king may breach a fence to make a path for himself, and we don't protest." There was a whole discussion over there. He was in some danger. He wanted to know if he was allowed to cause some damage to private property in order to save himself. And they told him normally it wouldn't be so simple, but in your case, you're the king, and a king can do what he wants. And that really tells us that a king, a monarch, which is the system of government espoused by the Torah on a very basic level. We will talk about where democracy finds its place in a Jewish halachic society as we move on. A king can do what he wants, and that would really preclude any discussion of conflict of interest. If you can go ahead and the discussion over there burn down someone else's field to flush out the enemy soldiers who are hiding therein, that kind of leaves conflicts of interest a moot point, because he's the king and the king has absolute power. Having said that, the question, like I said, becomes, where does the question come up? And when I decided to research this topic, and I spoke to Ben, I said to myself, where does democracy come up in Torah law? Well, for many, many years, this was especially true when, as the Jews lived in Europe for well over 1,000 years, there evolved a communal system, a communal structure in the communities, and this was already somewhat in place in Talmudic times, and this system was something known as the Tuvei Ha'ir. Tuvei Ha'ir basically means the caretakers of the city. There's a whole discussion unto itself, how they're elected, how many of them are there supposed to be, how do they come to power, and so on and so forth. That's not our discussion now. What we're going to try to focus on is what their duties are as those caretakers vis-a-vis their conflicts of interest. As we'll see, you can imagine if you have a little shtetl, a little village of some 20, 30 families somewhere in some small Russian town somewhere in Europe, and you're going to elect 7 members, there are going to be conflicts of interest. And so how do you deal with this? So we'll start with source number 2. And just to determine what their status is, so Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, in a response, he says that these two, these caretakers of the city, in any place where they're discussed, It doesn't mean to say they are the wisest, the oldest, or the wealthiest members of the community. That's not whom we're looking to elect, but rather those who expend the most effort on behalf of the public. So right off the bat, the ideal person to lead a community as part of a council, if you will, and generally that council, I should add, is seven members. Okay, so generally it's a council of seven members dealing with communal affairs. We should look for the ones who are capable and are involved in public affairs, not the ones who are necessarily the wisest, the oldest, the wealthiest. Certainly not the ones who are on it for an ego trip, but the ones who are interested in helping out the community. Okay, they use this term perhaps a little bit too loosely, public servant. Some people forgot the servant part. So, but that's ideally what it's supposed to be about, a public servant. And that's really the idea. And I should add, in the Talmud, it's expressed that there were several great Talmudic sages who were appointed to positions of authority in a particular area, and they came to their teacher and they said, "We don't want these positions of power." And their teacher said, "You think I'm giving you power? I'm making you servants. That's what you are. You're now servants of the public. And don't you forget it." Okay? And that's really the viewpoint that we have to take over here. You're a public servant, and that's your responsibility. So if we'll continue to source number three, the caretakers of the community whom are appointed to be involved in public needs or the needs of individuals, meaning whether it's an overarching public issue or helping out the individuals in the community, are similar to judges. And it is forbidden to appoint among them one who is invalidated to judge due to wickedness. And this is a very important point, not just because obviously you don't want to appoint a wicked, evil person as a leader, but the idea being expressed here by the Ramah, that's an acronym for Rabbi Moshe Israelis, 16th century Krakow, Poland. The point he's making over here is more than just whom to appoint. It's that these appointees, and to a very large degree, have the same status as a judge. You're making decisions that affect people. And to that extent, the things which Jewish law, halacha, would use to say a judge is invalidated or a judge cannot engage in certain activities would to a large degree apply to these appointees as well. All right? And so really we have to focus then on the rules of judges. And I discussed that with Judge Richmond a couple months ago. You'll have to go listen to the recording or speak to him after the class if you'd like. But suffice it to say, there are many rules that apply, A, to the conduct of judges, as we'll talk about bribery, obviously, and other issues, and who can be appointed as a judge. To a large degree, would apply to these appointees as well. That brings us to source number four. Come and see the important matter our teacher has informed us. This is a commentary to an earlier authority, and so he's commentating on what was written, that he's teaching us that a bribe is forbidden even though it is not regarding a Torah law, meaning you have someone making a decision on an issue that is not directly relevant to Torah law. Normally, if you go to a court of law, in front of a Jewish court of law with judges, they're going to decide the case based on Torah, Talmudic, halachic law. This may not be connected to it, but rather we're talking about a situation where a fine was being levied by the local governmental body because of something that had taken place. And I bring this to inform those who are appointed over the public that even though their judgment is not Torah law, again, they're not Talmudic or Torah judges, they're just appointees, and they were not accepted for this purpose, nonetheless, they must take care not to accept gifts for their judgments. Okay? So here again, he makes the point very clear. You are a member of this council. You have a responsibility towards the community. You have to make sure not to take gifts on behalf of your judgment. And of course, the question becomes, how far do we take that? Where do you draw the line? You talk about the idea of emoluments. Where do you draw the line of not taking a gift for my judgment? So, okay, I'm not going to take a gift in order to pass a law or an executive order, for that matter, that is favorable to one party or to another party, to one country, to another country, to one despot or to another despot, but where do you draw the line? So that, we'll see, is not so clear. But the idea is there. The idea of the responsibility of those caretakers of the community to be careful in receiving gifts certainly plays a major role over here. Okay, and how far does this go? So if you look at source number five, there's really what would appear to be a very extreme statement from an authority by the name of Rabbi Yecheskel Landau, 17th, early 18th century Prague. A very great authority leader. He was actually had friends high up in the government as well, and he wrote a work of various response on halachic issues. And he says the following: in a matter that they themselves, these caretakers, have an interest in, they are not called the tuvei ha'ir. For can the tuvei ha'ir, these caretakers, be valid to judge themselves? And he's talking about just, I believe, a situation of levying taxes on the community. Okay. Keep in mind that in Europe, in many areas of Europe, where the Jews had at various times and various locales some degree of freedom, some degree, and perhaps even autonomy. And so the government would allow them to set up their own system of communal government, but very often they would have to pay a tax to the government, and it would be upon the communal leaders to collect that tax from the community. Well, who's paying the taxes? It's up to the communal leaders to decide how that tax is being paid. So Rabbi Landau is making a point over here and saying that the caretakers cannot sit down and decide who's paying the tax and who's not, because that is directly relevant to them. How do they decide? That's a broader discussion, but the simplest answer is that they have a referendum where everyone votes and everyone states their opinion, and there's a whole discussion how that works and who does vote and who doesn't vote and how do we count the votes and how do we rely on people to look out for the communal interest and not their own narrow interest. That's a whole discussion. But for now, what he's saying is they can't vote on something which they have a direct interest in, which would seem to severely limit the power of these tuvei ha'ir, these caretakers of the city. What then can they decide? The swimming pools open up in town? Which games are being played at home and which games are being played away? Where would they have power? Seemingly, many, many communal issues would be something that they have an interest in. So there are earlier sources, and I mentioned Rabbi Landau lived in 17th, 18th century Prague. If you look at source number 6, the response of the Rashba. Rashba is an acronym for Rabbi Shlomo Ben Azeres. He lived in 13th century Spain. And he was a very, very great authority over there in Spain. And he brings up the following point, and he says, he was asked the following question. Is it found that these matters, meaning that a person cannot testify for a relative because the law is, Jewish law, halacha states, that a person cannot testify on behalf of a relative nor be a judge in a case involving a relative. Was this law set in regular matters, but for communal matters, they were not set? That was the question he was asked. Can we, I guess, overlook, bypass the law against a relative when it comes to communal matters? And he says, we have seen that there would be no way to rectify, to arrange anything for public needs, if we would say that the public needs to bring witnesses from outside who are valid vis-a-vis the entire community, who are not related to anyone in the community. So he makes the point that if we impose upon a community, and again, you have a lot of small communities, the need to have witnesses, judges, caretakers, who are not related to anyone in the community, that's going to make life virtually impossible to accomplish anything. Every time you need a witness, you have to send out put an ad in the paper in all the cities around, looking for someone not related to anyone in the town. It would make life very, very difficult. And so he continues in a different responsa. If you look at source number 7, he says, this is also obvious that there is nothing to say once the community has agreed. Okay, he'll expand on this idea as we move on. And this is how all communities have conducted themselves in regard to taxes, that they judge the members of the city and bring proofs for members of the city, even though they are related to the judges and to those being judged. And furthermore, the court and the witnesses have an interest in their own testimony and judgment and are testifying on their own behalf, and all this is based upon the agreement of the community. And here we have really a very important point that he makes. And that is because, as he mentioned earlier, the impossibility of being able to govern a community when, again, if you have especially a smaller community, if you're going to impose all the rules and regulations that normally invalidate witnesses and judges, because everyone, especially in a small Jewish community, this is certainly in the days before car travel, air travel, and so on, so it was extremely common. People would marry, you would have families that are married to each other, and so on and so forth. It's just impossible. So he says, the community has the ability to set up basically bylaws of how the community government will function. And if the community has agreed that you can have judges, witnesses, by extension, caretakers, the two ve'ir, these caretakers of the city, whom are, even though they are related to other people in the town, but they can still be there because what else are you going to do? And that's based on the agreement of the city. At some point, everyone votes on this. These are the bylaws. This is what we can do. This is what we cannot do. And that would allow some wiggle room, some flexibility to allow the government's governance to take place. Okay?
Is that in relation to allocating taxes? Are all these cases in relation to allocating the
taxes? A lot of them are talking about allocating
taxes. Okay.
Yeah, a lot of these cases are. We'll see in a moment a different case, but a lot of these cases are about taxes. There are other issues that come up as well. There are cases that come up in some of these sources in terms of the election of the rabbi of the city or of the shochet, the slaughterer who is going to slaughter the animals and make sure they're kosher, so on and so forth. You can imagine small town politics when it comes to electing the rabbi or things like that. You can imagine, and so if you read some of these responsa, you see the more things change, the more they stay the same. And very little has changed over the course of thousands of years, that there's, you know, the stuff they were worried about then is still going on now in terms of he wanted to elect his friend. No, but he was his brother, and it seems one case where they bought the votes, and there are all sorts of sordid cases going on, and you think, well, today this goes on. This is going on forever. So that is what he says. And by extension, this would really mean that even if you have a conflict of interest, potentially a conflict of interest, that based on what the bylaws are of the community, you can bypass that because within the community, that's how they set it up. If we were to superimpose that upon our democracy here in the United States, okay, let's just say, and we wanted to see how that lines up with Torah law, with halacha, one could then make the argument that the laws are in place. You have a democracy. You set up laws where the Congress votes, they're elected, and so on and so forth. So if those are the laws in place, those are the laws in place. Where you draw the line, is it $59, is it $62 as far as a gift? Is it a problem if you...
Sure, huh? And let me jump in here. So going back to the state and local gift bans, so there's in Amendment 41, which is the state gift ban, there's a threshold that state officials cannot accept a gift over $59. It's a very, very tight standard, and there's minor exceptions, you know, like gifts from a family member on a special occasion, you know, like a wedding, but in general, it state law really is
it's very tight.
Very tight versus the City of Denver Ethics Code, which there's a requirement that there be a connection between the gift and the person in power having the ability to act on, say, a contract or, you know, some sort of approval. So the idea is that influence requires the ability of somebody to do something. Where?
Right.
That's for someone to pay.
Well, so in the Denver City Ethics Code, basically it means that you cannot accept a gift if you are in a position to affect some kind
right.
of outcome.
If you have an existing relationship with the donor, is what it says. So it's different from the state code, which is you can't accept a gift, period, over $59.
Over $59.
By the way, I don't want to get into this, but there's a big conflict between these two, and there's a controversy going right now in the state legislature whether the 41 is going to override the Denver Ethics Code. That's a whole separate issue. But that's going on.
That's
now.
The next
can't
wave.
Really talk about
that. Because what, the state law supersedes the...
No, because the Amendment 41 makes an exception for home rule cities, but they're reading that in a very sort of narrow kind of
right,
way.
Right, and home rules... Yeah. So that's...
It's a whole complex other question. But you'll hear about it. You'll read about it in the newspaper because it's going on right now. Okay.
So, yes, thank you for that, Ben. So again... Getting back to our discussion of putting these two together, from a halachic standpoint, it would very much depend on the local area and what their bylaws are, what they accepted beforehand. So yes, there's Torah law that would be seems to be very narrow and inflexible in terms of a person being in a position of having to make judgments that affect other people. But as the Rashba tells us, that makes it impossible to govern, and so there has to be flexibility, and the local populace will determine how that should be put into place, and you can act accordingly. This is talking about levying taxes, but I would imagine the same thing would apply in terms of accepting gifts, and so on and so forth. Again, just imagine if you have a town of 40, 50 families, and you can't give birthday gifts to anyone in any position of power or anything like that, or take them, on a trip. It wouldn't make for great neighbors. And so certainly you would have to have some degree of wiggle room on that in terms of making enactments in the town.
Is there any attempt to use this RASPA to allow for judges to be within the community?
Part of what he's talking about is a judge. The question you raise is it could be a judge in a regular court of law, but it would seem like that these ideas apply to when they're judging communal issues, not individual. So if person A comes into a Jewish court of law, a bezdin, a beit din, and says person B, smashed my car, and person B is the judge's brother, you wouldn't be able to use those bylaws to say, oh, I can judge those bylaws. If you're talking about what are the laws in the town, when person A smashes the car of person B, okay, and the judge is, brothers with an individual who has a habit of crashing a lot, so then perhaps he would be allowed to make the judge, or if he himself perhaps has a history of accidents or parking tickets, whatever it may be, it would seem like he would have the room to still judge in the case or to be a member of the council and to discuss it. There is talk in some of the later authorities I mentioned. There's a lot of talk that I'm just trying to bring down some of the basic ideas here about how far that goes. Where do you draw the line between communal and individual? I think Mr. Trump is a very good example, President Trump now, because on the one hand, he's the president, but there's a lot of private stuff he's dealing with in terms of businesses, which is really his private businesses. Whereas, for example, President Obama receives a Nobel Peace Prize. The argument can easily be made that's a much more communal issue in terms of he received that prize for his actions as the president of the United States. You can make the argument that's more of a communal thing as opposed to where my private business, my hotel, I have people of power staying there who are of influence. There's a lot of talk where you draw the line between individual and communal. Where does that cross over in terms of making those kinds of calls and decisions? There is a lot of talk about that. This is just the overarching idea.
I see a difference between setting policy and applying that policy.
The question is, at what point do you cross over between, this is called setting policy, that's called applying, then there seems to be discussion, where do you call it communal, where do you call it individual?
I'll give you a concrete example. They can set the speed limit, but to decide whether a certain person violated the speed limit when he crashed into the car is more of a private dispute. Setting the speed limit is certainly a public issue.
Right. Now, one can make the argument that, let's say there's one guy in town who is consistently speeding, and that guy happens to be the judge, they say, we're setting policy. We know why we're setting the policy. So there the argument could be made.
Raising the speed limit?
Yeah. I mentioned to Ben that, the fact that they wanted to, one of the things President Trump wanted to do was to set term limits on Congress. Who votes on that?
Congress.
So what are the odds of Congress voting to set term limits? And so I think one of the ideas being floated was that they will grandfather in all the current members of Congress, so it doesn't affect them directly. But that brings us to source number 8. You're not too happy about that. Okay, this is a very, very fascinating issue over here. In source number 8, this is the response of the Rashbash. You get some interesting names on acronyms over here. Rashbash stands for Rabbi Shimon Ben. I think Rabbi Shlomo Ben Shimon, I believe. And he was again a Spanish or perhaps Algerian Sephardic authority. And here is the story behind this case. Very, very interesting. There was a fellow who left his entire library to the community. Okay. The problem was the community was split in two. There were two communities within this one city, and the question was, to whom did he leave it? To community A or community B within said city? And there were witnesses who were coming to testify over what his intent was, but these witnesses were members of one of the communities. And so the question was, can they testify over whom he really left it to? And so he brings he invokes this Rashba, this opinion of the Rashba, about the idea of there being bylaws for communal matters, that they are allowed to testify. But he adds and he says the following. He says, I found a way to trust them. And this is really very, I think, very pertinent to our discussion here today and to what's going on now. That two people, these two witnesses, remove themselves from the community in this matter, and they write a document. They have no rights to these books.
A blind trust.
Exactly. Well, it's even less. They're actually going to divest themselves completely of any ownership. Not only do they have no part in them, but also their children and children's children forever, and also their relatives. Okay, so see how far he's going with this. Okay, no son-in-laws either there. Because there is this, and he continues, and he says, because there is deceit in this, it requires an investigation of a court of wise and understanding, God-fearing, truthful individuals. So he doesn't really mince words over here in terms of what's going on over here, that yes, perhaps you have wiggle room in terms of this idea of governing on communal matters allows you to kind of ignore, bypass, to sideline this issue of conflict of interest because of family issues. But he says over here you have a way to avoid the whole thing, and that is for two people to divest themselves when he writes to it. And that's what he seems to advise, and he extends it to other family members as well. And he says because there tends to be a lot of deceit in these areas, you really need to look into it properly by wise, understanding, God-fearing, truthful people. I think enough said on that. So that's just an application of this idea, and you see just how fluid this kind of law can be in terms of its practical application. It really depends on the time, on the community, on the practicality of it happening. He seemed to think that it was practical to find two people who would divest themselves. He does point out, he says, if this were to be a fight over a Torah scroll, where the entire community uses the Torah scroll on a regular basis, my idea would not work. But this is a library of books. A lot of people are never going to touch those books or look at those books. So you can find two people who aren't interested in this library. Whereas if it's something which is used by the whole community, a Torah scroll, everyone goes to the synagogue and everyone's going to use benefit, that's a lot more difficult to say this idea. So it really depends very much on every particular case and situation. Okay, two more sources, and then I think we can open up to more discussion. The appointees of a city who place the taxes upon the residents of the city based on their assessment, they need to be careful not to flatter one person and excessively impose upon another so that they not be invalidated for testimony or taking oath. The reason for that last part of it is because there's a broader discussion of the classic tax collector, the unscrupulous tax collector in the community, and that if you have an unscrupulous tax collector, he may be invalidated for testimony because he's unscrupulous. Mm-hmm. And he extends that, Rabbi Israelis, into the discussion of the appointees of the city. They too can fall prey to unscrupulous practices if they have a conflict of interest. They are flattering and being nice to one person, easing off their tax load and unnecessarily weighing upon, placing that weight upon others. And so he says they have to be very careful not to flatter one. He's not talking about receiving gifts or anything like that. He's just saying the idea of showing favoritism is very problematic. Okay, and again, this is the idea that you have these people who are being watched, and if they are indeed unscrupulous and they are using their position of power to favor some and to impose unfavorable conditions upon others, it may in fact invalidate them as witnesses because they're not trustworthy individuals anymore. That brings us to the last source, and that is the question that Ben raised about even if it's legal. Even if it's legal according to the law, should one be concerned about appearances? And here we have a response of the Tashbatz. We have another acronym. Tashbatz stands for Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach. Okay, the aforementioned Rashbash by Shlomo ben Shimon. The Shimon of that name is this person. So it's father and son. So source number 8 is the son of source number 10. Anyways, again, a Spanish authority. He says, from here we can learn how much one must be careful, even beyond the norm, regarding the property of the public, and to help them as much as possible, and to be clean from Hashem, from God, and Yisrael. This is he's invoking a verse in the Torah, which the Talmud says that one needs to take great caution in making sure that one's actions do not have the appearance of impropriety. Even if legally they're within bounds, the Talmud says that when they would send a messenger into the temple to withdraw money from the treasury, he had to go in with clothing that had no hems or pockets or receptacles whatsoever. Because later on, he seemed to be doing well financially. People would say, you know why he's doing well financially? He filled up his pockets when he went in. They said he couldn't even have hems on his clothing because he could put the money inside the hem of his pants or something like that. And that's how far it goes. So this is invoked over here that a public servant needs to be careful as well, not to stray to the right or left in the proper path, and should not show favor to any person. How far do you take this? Again, where do you draw the line between public perception of what I'm doing and what's legal? Ben points out the case of the Super Bowl, and I pointed out to Ben when we met last week that on the one hand, Mayor John Hancock, and for that, Michael Hancock, or Governor John Hickenlooper. John Hancock is someone else. Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to leave my signature on this class. Either one of them, yes, they're going to enjoy a Super Bowl. But let's face it, we all know very well that when your team is in the Super Bowl, it's a very public. It's an opportunity for the city, for the state to be on display. The mayor is always making bets of some silly thing they're going to do if their team loses and whatever it is. And it's an opportunity to promote your city. And you can easily make the argument that I'm doing this on the dime of the taxpayers because this is for your benefit. I'm going to wherever this game is taking place, and it's nationally broadcast for forever, 2 weeks. It's all over the place. And people are watching and seeing this, so this is part of my public service. And you can make that argument. And he certainly, again, where you draw the line, I think to some degree is a matter of personal decision. But certainly, I could agree with a position that he could get up and say, and he should say, look, this is an opportunity for advancing the interests of the city, of the state, and therefore, I'm using taxpayer money to go to this game. Am I going to watch the game and enjoy it? Yes. Am I going to hope that my team wins? I sure hope so, or I'm going to have to cave in for that bet. But he certainly can advance the argument that it's for on behalf of the taxpayers, and it doesn't really, at least to me, my personal opinion, if he makes that argument to me, I would accept that argument. So assuming that he's doing something, he just has to bear in mind that he needs to sometimes explain their actions. If there appears to be a conflict of interest, if the citizenry would like you to perhaps release your tax documents and you don't, that certainly gives the appearance of something is up over here. Again, I'm not weighing in on the particular situation, but to me, if you don't want to release and you're making all sorts of excuses, it doesn't look great. And so you have this idea, again, from a Torah standpoint, of the obligation of keeping your nose clean. And avoiding the appearance of anything that looks improper, even if technically it's legal. That's the end of my presentation. Right. Questions or discussion?
Yeah, maybe we could take a question or two, or if anybody has a discussion point that they want to talk about before we wrap up.
So my question is, to what degree does disclosing or being transparent about this, the idea of sharing a tax return, or in Denver's case, if you write down what the gift was, then okay, I receive it. I mean, to what extent does that really make it okay, and how does that change the nature of receiving the gift?
You want to from
both sides, whether it's
I think from a the side of an in-house counsel, it helps with the perception issue that if I'm going to accept a gift, I'm letting everybody know what it is so that, if I can be questioned, you can go ahead, publicly you can question my ability to be unbiased or impartial. So I think, in terms of the state gift ban, and you have in the emoluments clause that Trump can be very transparent about it and go seek approval of Congress, which I'm not sure that he would get. But I think the transparency helps with perception, but I don't think it changes the analysis as to whether there's influence there.
Does reporting the gift excuse accepting the gift?
No, it does not.
No,
The Colorado law is very clear that over $59, and if you don't fall in the exceptions, you can't accept the gift. Right. And so it doesn't matter how transparent you are; you just can't accept it.
I just answer, from the side of halacha, of Jewish law, I would say that yes, in terms of the last source of avoiding the appearance of anything improper, certainly one should give some degree of transparency. It doesn't mean you have to expose everything, but to the extent of what the norms are, and I think the part of the discussion was that virtually every past candidate for the past however many years has given out those tax returns. That's an expectation. Does it absolve you once you've said it of a conflict of interest? Absolutely not. That's the other discussion. You know, just the idea of I'm going to do this. I may have the legal wiggle room to do it, but does it give over the appearance of impropriety? That's a separate discussion that has to be dealt with as well. It won't necessarily absolve you of the other issues that I discussed earlier.
With regard to the emoluments clause in Constitution, weren't the founding fathers that were presidents, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, weren't they very wealthy people that were involved in business? And
yeah, absolutely. I think it shows the, you know, and going back thousands of years, it shows that this is a timeless issue with caretakers of the community.
Remember, emoluments is with respect to basically a foreign state. Emoluments doesn't necessarily apply accepting a gift from a domestic entity, okay? The way I read it, it's just a foreign state.
Yeah.
Prince or something like that.
This was in a time of kings and monarchs and titles and nobility.
Right. So it's not.
So perhaps.
Remember, their bribery statutes are something totally different, okay?
Yeah, right.
If you take something from anybody, a public official, for a quid pro quo, that's a whole different issue. That's potentially a criminal act. But the emoluments clause is strictly a constitutional provision from a foreign agency, right? And it doesn't say you have to do anything for the foreign government. But if one were to accept an emolument, that would violate that provision of the Constitution. That's what this lawsuit is alleging.
But it has to be a gift.
Yes. If that's what emolument means, I don't know, Sandy, if that's what it means.
Go ahead.
How did you explain the Super Bowl tickets?
So he paid for himself. He didn't accept a gift, so that was clearly okay. Yeah, that's correct. But his the issue was with regard to his staff, who are public officials. Can they accept airfare and lodging to go to the Super Bowl, even though they pay for it themselves? And the way he justified that was they were serving him in addressing the press, going back to this idea that Hickenlooper was promoting the state and getting good press. And so
there's a governmental purpose connected with the trip, the government official can accept some funding for that trip. For example, the mayor goes to the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting every year, and somebody else may pay for that. Or I go to judicial clinics, and they pay for our travel expenses, but it's for...
the
sponsor of the seminar.
Conference.
Yeah, they want judges to come so they can, promote them. So they say, here, we'll give you a scholarship, they call it, and they send us, they waive the fee and they give us airfare.
And who pays for the conference? Where's that money coming from?
Sometimes it comes from our own budget, and sometimes they just waive the fee, the conference fee. But they even pay for our travel expenses, provided it's a judicial matter. I've never been invited to the Super Bowl, though.
All right.
Or the World Series, for that matter.
So I think that's a good place to leave it. Okay. Thank you all for coming.
I have to come next month. You're Ken Stern.
Yeah, yeah. You want to moderate next month?
Yeah, I'll do it again.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
Very good.
Was that it?
I like the
book. Yeah.
It's interesting.